Hello, today we're speaking with Timothy Kim, founder and CEO of IBV Energy Partners. Welcome to the podcast, Timothy.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Brilliant. To start, could you tell us a little bit about IBV Energy Partners?
Yeah, so we are a utility scale solar and storage development and primary investment company. And what that really means is that we develop large-scale power plants, solar power plants. Usually it's sited on, I think our average is sited on a little over 1,000 acres of land these days. And we develop and operate them and sell the electricity to various customers, from utilities to corporates such as Amazon, Meta, Google, to power agencies and municipalities. I started the company in June of 2017 with Robin Size, our co-founder, who's also our executive VP and head of development. Him and I had worked at a previous company in Florida. He was the head of development. I was the head of finance and M&A, and we just clicked really well. Our battle rhythm synced, and 2017, off we went, and it's been a journey since.
And I guess in 2017, when you were making that initial decision, how did you see the opportunity at that point? Why did it make sense to say, okay, Robin and I, we're going to get into it together?
Well, if I'm going to be honest with you, it actually did not make sense.
Right.
You know, in 2017, right? So this was 6 months after the Trump administration came in. I'm not trying to be political. I'm just stating facts here. And the administration and its federal policies towards renewables was not friendly. In the same year, there were significant tariffs imposed specifically on solar panels, which make up about 40 to 50% of the plant's investment, right? And then there were subsequent tariffs on major components that make up a solar power plant, including the substructure, the steel of the substructure, as well as semiconductors and the inverters. In many cases, they were just outright bans, actually. So, you know, in one case, Huawei, you know, as many people, if you could remember back then, it was basically banned from the federal government, as well as hooking into any critical infrastructure, telecommunications, as well as energy. So, but look, you know, oftentimes when things don't make sense, the contrarian that I am, I kind of look at the long term and ask, does it make sense for the long term? And energy has always made sense in the long term, the advent and the development of energy, and especially new technology. And so from that angle, the story was very robust. Investors were half in, half out. You know, there are a number of federal legislations that were about to expire, but we found an excellent home with IB Float Group, which is the largest pure solar IPP, independent power producer, in the world, having done some of the major firsts in the world when it comes to developing and operating solar power plants. So the challenge back then, when you're starting a company, you're ambitious and you want to get into those big league tables, is and the question I was always obsessed with is, how do we go in this very fluid environment? How do we go from the back of the line, you know, just starting up, to the very front of the line without, you know, taking these baby steps, but, you know, giant leaps? And I think that's what really occupied our minds in the first 3 to 4 years, I would say, until COVID came along. And these days, we now have, you know, we fast forward, you know, 5 years later, we have approximately 8 gigawatt of solar and storage assets in the queue. We're one of the largest developers of solar in Nevada. We're the largest developer of solar in Kentucky and Louisiana. And we're working with a number of power customers, both in the renewables and the utility space and the oil and gas space. And we work with approximately 50 landowners now to develop solar on over 50,000 acres across the United States. So the story is strong, and I think the fundamentals are strong. Looking back in 2017, we came out of this fiery arena into something that looks a little bit more stable now. So
yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating, you know, the timing, right? And being a bit too early is completely fine, right? Because you kind of have to get through those couple of years. And then if you hit that market inflection point, which we're clearly in now, you get all that benefit of having laid the groundwork in those kind of tougher years. And you also have, I guess, a kind of leaner mentality around certain things, right?
Exactly.
I guess one of the kind of frameworks, so we're talking about utility scale, these very large 1,000-acre plus projects, and there's a few other flavors, of course, of development. We've seen a big rise with community solar, which are typically in the 20 to maybe 100 or 200-acre parcel or project size. And then, of course, you have a commercial industrial that go below that, let alone the kind of roof-mounted direction. When you're kind of weighing up, why did utility scale like appeal to you relative to maybe some of these other options?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. For us, it's optimization and efficiency, and that's it. It would be relatively easier to develop community solar. I don't want to say it's easy at all. I mean, it's not, you know, no facet of development is easy.
Sure.
But developing it with the community as your power customers on land, often, if not granted to you, then directed to you by the community, is a lot easier than developing on a 1,000-acre farmland, where many folks decry the use of solar as a conditional use. However, with that being said, you know, when I started in this field in 2007, the cost of solar was somewhere around $4 a watt. You know, you fast forward from 2007 to 2015, and the cost of solar in 2015 was approximately $1.25, $1.35 a watt. To pre-pandemic 2019, where it was about 85 cents a watt. You can only achieve that type of efficiency through utility scale solar, because just the sheer amount of power that you are placing, you are siting in one area. The other part of this is optimization, as I mentioned. You know, optimization going forward is going to play a large role in the autonomous side of solar deployment, solar operations. We believe that, you know, doing things at a bigger scale lends itself to more optimization practices than doing things at a much smaller scale, where you are often kind of boxed in into your own design. So this is the reason why we went large.
Absolutely. But then I guess the trade-off, so in large, and for the listener, you know, we're talking, I guess, $100 million plus projects in a kind of typical deployment for those who are less familiar with watts of various types. But then in terms of absolutely, it makes sense. Those efficiencies, you know, large scale generates these efficiencies, and it absolutely drives the entire industry forward and gets us to a much healthier mix of electricity from a renewables point of view. But I guess then, what are some of the major challenges when you're trying to develop a 1,000-acre plus project?
Well, there's two challenges in developing projects these days. There used to be three challenges. So let me just quickly go over those three and then tell you why it's now two. Prior, the three challenges was, and in this order, securing a power customer, or what we call an off-taker, to buy your electricity, right? Renewable energy is new. Utilities don't really understand, did not in the past, you know, you're talking about mid-2000s, did not really understand it. It was not pervasive across the United States. And corporates, the rise of corporates as clean energy procurers had not materialized until about 2017, 2018. So that's one. And that's important because at the end of the day, you could have a fantastic project, but if you don't have revenues, a contracted revenue to underpin it, then you're not going to get financing for it. So the project is likely not to be built. Second, the grid. The grid is highly congested. This was not an issue so much in the past, because back in 2015, 17, your big size projects were 50 to 100 megawatts, right? I mean, if you did 100 megawatts in 2015, 16, like I did, you were kind of sitting at the upper echelons of solar development. These days, that's kind of the lower end of utility scale. To give you an idea, our portfolio average size 175 megawatts, and we're soon to be moving up to 200 megawatts, our largest project being well over 300 megawatts. So you know, again, efficiency and optimization going against the power curve, reducing the levelized cost of solar electricity all plays a role in. The third is, obviously, when you go into a community, and the vast majority, I would probably say somewhere way above 90%, of large-scale solar farms do not sit in municipal land, because there just isn't, you know, enough land in the municipality, or it's so expensive that it just, you know, does not make it worthwhile. And in, you know, largely it sits in unincorporated county land, so where a lot of people reside as well. So obviously it has impact on our community, and the community, there has been some, or has been more than some, there's been a lot of debates about the use of prime farmland. And I'm proud to say that IBV Energy Partners, we design everything with dual use, meaning that, you know, we add pollinators, the sheep could feed off of the grass where feasible. We invite livestock on our site to have that in tune with nature type of aesthetics for our plants. But those are the three. The offtake portion, the first one I talked to you about, has gone away for the most part. That is not as difficult as it once was. So now it is about congestion and community. To just give you an idea, we've had a series of articles on this. Our first article, you know, thanks to Matt, has been how solar development developers can work with communities and could work with landowners. And it doesn't need to be one or the other. Solar will never take over, you know, even a significant amount of prime farmland. And so I think there's a lot of myths out there, but we view part of our job as educating as well as informing the public of what those myths are and how we get around it and how we can work together.
Yeah, as listeners of the podcast knows, you know, I grew up on a sheep farm, and so agrivoltaics and being able to have dual use of land, I think, is something that it's fantastic to hear you're doing. I think a lot of solar developers historically, it was kind of an afterthought. And as all the prime areas to build, prime both from a farmland as well as a solar point of view, are being kind of looked at, and landowners and farmers are being asked to kind of consider these different options, I think having that dual use and enabling the farmer and the community that farmer is in to say, okay, we are still having that engagement with the land, right? Because it is very powerful, because farmers are, very few people decide to become a farmer, right? It's usually this kind of very, very cultural and familial structure that you're born into. And I think anything that solar developers do to kind of meet the farmer halfway, I think is going to, on net, be a massive benefit to both parties.
Right, exactly. I there's one more thing to be said about this, though. And in this country, we do believe, and I firmly personally believe, in the rights of the landowner. There's long history about private use of land and what you can and cannot do as long as it doesn't hurt existing surrounding landowners. You should be able to do what you feel you need to do with your land, the land that you worked so hard and your family worked so hard to either put together or inherited and farmed or tilled or whatnot. The interesting part here is that the folks who are against solar development largely are not farmers. It's surprising to hear this because you would think they are, but in fact, it is not them at all. They are actually highly encouraging for solar development use. Not only from a financial benefit, right? I mean, you got 35, 40, 45 years of lease revenue, but from the point of view that they cobble together, a lot of them have cobbled together this land over decade, two decades, three decades, or even generations. And they feel that they have worked hard enough, their family has worked hard, and now they want to reap some of the benefits of passive investments. So it's a very interesting dynamic that's taking place in many rural areas of this country, where farmers are actually proponents of solar development, and the ones that are not have nothing really to do with their farm. They just don't like the idea for X, Y, and Z.
And you're seeing this in the rise of solar moratoriums that are happening at the subdivision level, where you might have a village, and then some folks at the village would be like, oh, you know, let's ban solar from our village and unincorporated surroundings for like the next 2 years. And, you know, I think technically there is some voting going on, but, you know, local democracy often struggles to actually get everybody in that locality to actually engage in it and really understand what's going on. And if something's passed that says there's a solar moratorium and you're not able to build for the next year and a half, 2 years, I guess the average landowner there is a bit out of luck.
Yeah, the solar moratorium is very concerning and borderline scary, because essentially what they are doing is, there are some communities, for example, we are developing a very large 275 megawatt solar farm in the southern area of Nevada. In this, within the city of Boulder City, as a matter of fact, we actually lease the property from the city. That's one of the very few projects where we actually lease it and where it's actually in the municipality. The city of Boulder City generates a lot of money from the lease of their solar farms. You know, they have a number of solar leases out in that area. And they've structured a program where they're very careful because they don't want to expand. They don't want to expand population. But they have to, you know, cover their expenses with some sort of revenue, and that revenue is solar. The amount of benefits that solar tax benefits, it's just hard benefits, really, that solar provides to county is innumerable. I mean, you're talking about, again, generations of tax impact, and to buy new equipment for the schools, provide scholarships, buy new equipment for the fire and police department. We see this. These are actually hard benefits. And so when there's a moratorium, often the county and the residents are saying that we don't want these benefits. And then they have to find a new source of revenue to cover costs. Everybody knows that infrastructure is aging, that school buildings are aging, and we may very well be in a recession, a long one next year. And it is our hope that we work with, you know, we certainly strive to work with counties to ensure that they understand this. But at the end of the day, like you said, James, is their choice. If they propose a solar moratorium, then I think they're just shooting themselves in the foot in the long run.
Yeah, I think one of the things that will change, because as people are becoming more familiar with the upsides of these projects, I think attitudes will change. Because right now it's like, I've seen something on TV, there might be some solar panels, that seems like a net good, but I don't really know a ton about them. I don't know those elements around that's going to positively affect the tax base within my community. And I think it's just going to take a little while as these things kind of spread out, as more people are exposed to them, that, because it's very easy to say no, right? It's often harder to say yes to things. And so seeing those kind of positive reasons, you know, having conversations like this, I'm sure the day-to-day work that you and your team do, reaching out and engaging the community and the landowners, and then those landowners then, I'm sure, are talking to their neighbors, and people are then starting to do the heavy, you know, day-to-day work of making, you know, making these things move in a more positive direction. But I guess, you know, with all these considerations, right? So where is the solar moratorium? Where's our less grid congestion? How do you work through all of that, different types of information to say, actually, you know what, this community with these 2,000 acres in this particular part of the country is actually a great place to build versus this other place one state away?
Yeah, that's another good question. First of all, before I answer that, let me just say that I don't want to pin this. Solar developers, we have not ourselves done a very good job of informing the company, informing the communities at large. We're now starting to do this, but we should have done this long time. Our industry should have done this long time ago. We should have made a push to decouple the story of solar from the politics of solar or the politics of green energy or clean energy. And so we have to understand that as an industry, we share a lot of that blame. And, you know, if you go to the websites of a lot of solar development companies, they still don't tell that story. They don't explain why they're doing what they're doing and how they're working with communities. You know, we recently revamped our website. And we added, the first thing we wanted to do was add a community section and then a long FAQ section, both under our project section as well as our community section, to let landowners and communities and officials and even people who are opposed to solar understand that, listen, we may not agree on everything, but we're going to be very transparent of how we're coming about this and why we're doing this and what the benefits are to you. So if you go to our website, ibvenergy.com, then you know, scroll through it, take a look at it. And we hope that the website is not just about us, but is about turning the tide on informing the public of investments and development in community initiatives, particularly when it comes to solar. The second part of this is to answer your question. We do what's called analytically driven development. That's kind of a fancy phrase, right? But anytime there a new industry pops up, you could trace this all the way, the oil and gas, semiconductor, any industry, aviation, there's always this cowboy mentality, right? And the cowboy mentality is just go fast, go hard, and let's figure out the rest later. And that happened in our industry, when this industry first began in 2006, a number of developers just went for a land grab and they weren't really thinking. And it even happens today, which is really unfortunate. We don't do that. We engage in analytically driven development where we take a pause and say, okay, we look at everything from the perspective of an investor, and we answer the hard questions. We spend a lot of time, a lot of resources, a lot of money on modeling out and researching and analyzing points of interconnection, making sure that we feel ourselves comfortable that there's enough capacity at certain substation, that the solar farm could be built, that there's no moratorium. We meet with county officials beforehand before we even touch a single piece of land. Because I think the industry has also suffered another blight, and that is that of a solar cowboy, the speculator that comes in, grabs land, makes big promises, and doesn't deliver. And we've had to, it makes everybody's job hard, and we don't want to do this. That's not who we are. And I think we're at the forefront, vanguard of where the industry has to change. We're certainly leading that charge.
And speaking of that, you know, I come from a software background. I'm actually, you know, working on some projects in this very space right now. Where would you like to see more innovation? You know, where could, you know, smart folks coming in, maybe with more of a software and data background, be building to service you better, solve some of your problems, get more projects developed?
Well, these days, there's, I think it was last week, you know, I almost never want to drop the name Elon Musk in anything because he's so, at the same time, controversial, but also so inspirational, you know, I mean, but he did come up with kind of this funny, I don't know if he was joking or not, but he said that either Tesla or somebody should develop software for developers to engage in more predictive and precise predictive analysis of grid congestion and the costs associated to plug in a solar power plant to the grid. That's the number one. I would say even more than the not in my backyard type of folks, congestion is actually the number one issue plaguing the industry right now. The inability to predict your network upgrades. So let's say that you have a power plant, you already spent $3 million developing studies, engineering, you know, permitting, all that stuff. Community is great with you. Everything looks fine. Everything looks clean. You go through this 4, 5, sometimes 6 year interconnection study cycle where you just have to put more money and more money and more money for every study that you want to advance to. And then all of a sudden you put $10 million at the end and the last study comes back and says that your project is now uneconomical. You just dropped $10 million. And do you think that those types of companies are going to come back from that? So we need a lot more engagement with the transmission organizations, the independent system operators, and folks who have the insight but are not willing to open source their information for the betterment of the industry. And hopefully software could plug a lot of that holes in bringing that information out from those transmission organizations and utilities into open source and then allowing developers such as ours a platform to subscribe to that information. That would be interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting because a lot of the space, like the incentives are just all not fully aligned in a way that would make these things easier and as easy as they should be, right? And so you often have the utility or the grid operator or the operator of the transmission, the ISO, whatever it may be, you know, they're incentivized for grid stability, right, of various types, and maybe a couple other incentives that are built into their model, whatever it may be. And then you have individual developers like yourselves who are trying to figure out, look, we know we're going to be building a lot of renewables. Just tell us where to build, right? Like at the end of the day, if you could just direct us and say, hey, 10 developers who are bidding into a particular market, it's definitely going to make sense to be along this 100-mile piece of transmission. And then you know, you'll still have to do the studies and we'll still have to make sure that things actually make sense, but at least give some kind of top-level direction. And I think there are definitely some kind of national initiatives I've been reading about and researching that I think will help with some of this at the margin. But I do think that until there is just a very, very strong bi-directional communication between developers and developer trade groups and those who are managing the transmission congestion and the capacity, I think some, you know, I don't know, like the Cold War needs to end to a certain extent so that we can eventually get that data revealed and then software people can build on top of that data.
Yeah, I think software has played a very outsized role in our company. You know, I was looking at our fiscal year 23 budget just today. And, you know, we're adding on 4 more software platforms. And these are not cheap, by the way, right? So the question, you know, a CEO always has to ask is, if I have that extra dollar, where do I spend it on? And it's more and more coming back on the software piece because just as this industry matures and becomes far more sophisticated, it's mimicking that of the oil and gas industry, which is already complex, right? And once it really starts ramping up that analytical chain, there's not enough people, not enough folks to keep up with the fast-moving information and its impacts to your portfolio, both from opportunity and risk perspective. So the software is going to be very, very important. And I see a lot of consolidation in the industry that's going to take place in the next 2 or 3 years. That's my prediction, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm also somewhat in this space myself in my own company. And there's a lot of companies in our size range in the kind of dozen or so people. And I agree. I think there will be quite a number fewer of us in a couple of years because there's a lot of, I think, duplication. And then once you string along some of these functionalities, I think then you start to have really powerful software, right? Like what is the Salesforce of development? I think that's a question, or the ERP system of development. I think that's a question that more and more people are going to start asking, but it's a pretty complicated piece of software, to your point. And I think that is going to take a while to emerge. But when it does emerge, I think it probably will be a combination of some of these smaller orgs. And I guess one of the, you know, so we talked about the kind of digital transformation of the space. And the other, I think, big piece that we touched on earlier briefly, but I think I would love to get in your thoughts on, is the Inflation Reduction Act. I've made this joke before, but I call it IRA because being Irish and from Ireland, I think, you know, calling it the IRA for the next decade is a bridge too far for me. So I guess IRA, I think it came out of the blue all of a sudden. There was a lot of false dawns around, you know, a climate bill coming out of the current Congress. And it finally passed. And I think it was a net probably more promising than I think a lot of people were expecting. How do you think it's going to, I guess, directly affect you guys over the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, I think the biggest effect here is that it provides confidence to investors. You know, solar developers, we're optimistic and we have to be by nature, right? So the moon or the sun is always up, the glass is always half full, regardless of what happens. But investors are of course, a different breed sometimes. Before the IRA, there were a number of debates, legislation, potential legislation that kind of came in and out of both administrations that were going to promise everything from the stars to nothing at all, right? And I think that made it very difficult for investors to understand, how do I plan capital allocation for the next X amount of years? And that's important because the life cycle of a development of just a single project, right? Just one project, say like a 100 megawatt project anywhere in the United States, is approximately 4 going on to 5 years now. That's how long it takes for you to conceive, from the time you conceive the project to the time that you build it, right? So you need to have this long path of confidence that from the time that you sign up, your option agreements, and your lease agreements, your land agreements, your power agreements, putting the first $1 million at the door in development capital, to the time you build it, there's actually going to be supportive legislation. And there was none of that before. So with the Inflation Reduction Act, more than anything, it says to investors, America is a safe place of investing. It's a long-term place for your investments. It's a stable place. And we have a renewed interest in seeing clean energy become a dominant form of the energy mix up until at least 2032 or whatever, you know. So, you know, that is how I look at it. And anytime that you speak to a CEO, they're always worried about their shareholder expectations, right? To understand, okay, well, there's only a finite amount of capital, both in the world and applied to our company. Where is the best way to use it? And when should I use it? And the when now is being answered by the propellant of the IRA. You're seeing a number of new projects and initiatives go into the queue and targeting even the manufacturing side of the bill, which, you know, it aims to bring panel manufacturing back home, back to the United States. So, of course, overall is a good thing. But you know, if you're remembering the Build Back Better Act, the climate change provision of that was something like $1.3 trillion. So, sure. IRA is now $370 billion. I mean, not just only, but it is $370 billion. So it's one-fourth, sort of give or take, of what we were trying to achieve. We'll make do. We'll be fine. But that also tells me that there's a lot more to go and that we could do a lot better as well.
And I think even with that, and I fully agree, you know, I think we're, because of that gap between the 1.3 and what just shy of 400, yeah. That came in. I think what we're going to be very reliant on is the cost curves for solar, and then also some of the operational and digitization elements, making things more efficient to bring down the cost, to make deployment, and then be very dependent on things like state and local initiatives who are, you know, making various commitments, as well as the corporate commitments of various types. Another piece that I've been kind of chatting to a few folks about is the labor side and talent side. How do you think about and talent mix available to develop the types of projects you work on, right? You're continuing to ramp up, develop ever more. You have, you know, traditional blue collar jobs that are, you know, are deploying the actual assets themselves. We've talked about the analytics. We talked about financing, developers, you know, they're going literally around in trucks to try to get things done. How do you think about how difficult it is? Do we have the right kind of talent mix? Are there gaps that we should have either policy or smart entrepreneurs should be looking at filling those gaps?
Yeah, I mean, two things on this. First, let's just go back to the IRA. It compels developers to use apprentices during the construction phase, as well as the operational phase, which is very smart because, you know, you want a catalyst to build long-term talent in this area, right? That's first of all. The second, you know, as a subset to that, through the IRA discussion, prevailing wage jobs are also going to be a large, very large part of solar construction moving forward. Prior to that, prevailing wage union jobs were only used when it had to be. So you're talking about California type projects, New England, you know, states where there was no right to work provision. But now you're talking about high paying wage jobs all throughout the United States, specifically tied to deployment of solar and wind and green hydro and everything else that that was kind of stuck under the IRA bill. So those two, apprenticeships and prevailing wage, are going to drive a lot of interest and movement of human capital towards this industry. I firmly believe that. The second part of it is more, I would say, the white collar jobs. The interesting thing is that we're now starting to see a number of folks, I don't know whether it's due to the IRA or you know, it's just kind of bound to happen, but a number of folks coming from other industries, mainly oil and gas and coal, coming into the renewable energy industry and bringing their talents and all their experience and sophisticated skills with them. So I think the question of will we have enough talent, it's really not for renewable energy industry. It's really for the oil and gas industry, because these days, if you're a energy major, bachelor's, master's, PhD, whatever you are, and you're kind of looking around and you're saying to yourself, where do I want to make my mark in the world? I don't know. I mean, oil and gas is, I don't really see many people going flocking towards that, you know, the generation of folks that are graduating. So I think in 5 to 10 years, oil and gas is going to have a talent problem if they're not already having one right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually talking to a Canadian oil and gas company who's actually made quite a ton of money recently with getting stuff out of the tar sands in southern Canada, and then with $100 a barrel recently. And their immediate kind of internal initiative is, how do we deploy this $4 billion into renewables? Because this is like a one-time increase in our net revenue. And to try to grow this kind of tiny fledgling renewables group that they have on the side of the business, because that's where all the upside is. And that's honestly, as you said, one of the ways they can, you know, retain talent and attract talent, by saying like, oh, we actually also have this piece. So that makes a ton of sense. Also, I was looking at your own background, and I saw that you spent a number of years in the Navy. How does that kind of influence how you build and lead a company?
Yeah, you know, I've gotten this question a lot, and I still haven't, and maybe for better or for worse, but I don't have an elevator pitch answer to that. I think it's affected me greatly. This is first. I would probably say it's been the main driver of the way that I manage the company, and the visions, the thoughts that I have, and how I bring that, materialize that to execution stage. Maybe one of these days I'll figure it out with a good psychologist how exactly it's impacted me. But I think it's impacted me in very soft ways that have accumulated into very hard approaches, into executable approaches into my personality. Look, I mean, anybody who's served in the military or served with folks, the military is a very can-do attitude. Right. It actually, and I'm still involved in a lot of national security and military initiatives. And I was reading one journal in the naval publication called Proceedings, where that can-do attitude is actually starting to become poisonous, because nobody's actually speaking truth to power anymore. They're just saying, yes, 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 we can do it. And if you find out, you cannot. But I think that's one of the main aspects that has affected me, that there is no such thing as a no. There's no such thing as you can't get that done. And then you kind of flank that with different skill sets like project management, leadership, organizational, et cetera, et cetera. And then you come up with kind of this talent ecosystem, which I think is very ripe for leading an organization such as the one we are in today. I will say that in the early stages, as I spoke about 2017, 18, 19, when this industry was going through some very difficult times, that to me, I think, was an interesting moment, interesting 3 years and even during COVID, because I also think that another thing that the military brings is adaptability, the ability to just really think about, analytically think about something and adapt to it, right? So it'd been a lot easier probably for me to have a bunch of nervous breakdowns. You know, we're just starting, we're just getting on. But I think having been in many situations where I had to adapt to very quick and volatile change year over year over year in the service led me to pretty much chill out and calm down and think about what was really important and think about the long game rather than having knee-jerk reactions all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I echo that. It's great decision-making. A lot of the qualities, these are exactly what, you know, people who found companies show in spades. But Timothy, this has been absolutely brilliant. Really enjoyed the conversation. Before we break off, is there anything I should have asked you about but did not?
No, a couple of things maybe. You know, we are hiring. Again, we hire very, very selectively, but we are hiring in a number of areas from analytics to development and to investments. So if folks are interested, please take a look at our website. Feel free to apply to those roles. And I always want to end these podcasts on a very optimistic note because, again, we are optimistic by nature. So I think what I want to also leave folks with is that we are on a very good track. We have hit the reset button with the Inflation Reduction Act, and the industry has lifted all barriers to achieving the most highest goals that we have set for ourselves. And so if you're not part of this industry and you're interested, you know, send your Google's news alert and follow the industry, follow us, follow our company. And I think you will be pleasantly surprised. And, you know, maybe it's not too much to say, hopefully, but it will restore your trust in humanity as to, you know, in this age where people are passing on a lot of misinformation, that there's this very bright spot with renewable energy professionals plowing ahead and ensuring that we have the right generation mix, the right resiliency, the clean energy for future generations.
Love that, Timothy. It's the people doing the work. Those are the ones that both have their own optimism and then drive optimism in the rest of us. Thank you so much. It's been brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you very much, James.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or the Google Play Store. I cannot express how appreciated it is, and we'll be back next week with another episode.